Good afternoon and welcome to the 18th briefing for municipal chief executive officers produced by the Baker-Polito administration. Ordinarily, and in just a few moments, the Lieutenant Governor will be joining to lead the presentation and the briefing of all the information that the administration has for local officials today. There are a lot of announcements, a lot of new material. She and the governor are finishing their weekly briefing for, or their daily briefing rather, for the resident citizens of Massachusetts in another part of the State House, and she'll be joining this briefing very shortly. So what we'll do is we'll now take a featured speaker for the administration, and that is Senior Associate Commissioner of Education, Russell Johnston, who will give an update and provide some information for all of us. So, Assistant Commissioner, thank you so much for being with us. Russell Johnston, the floor is yours. Oh, and let me just, once again, my name is Jeff Beckwith from the Massachusetts Municipal Association. Thank you all for joining us. And when we get to questions, please put them in the chat function. That's the forum that we'll use. Don't raise your hand, just put a question in the chat and we'll follow those as they go through. Sorry, Russell, I didn't mean to forget that part of the intro. So now the floor is all yours.
No, thank you, Jeff. Thanks very much. And really a pleasure to be with you here today. The timing of our discussion today could not be better because, as Jeff mentioned, the governor and the lieutenant governor are doing their briefing and actually talking about a topic that will be very relevant to this discussion today, which is about metrics and how we can use metrics to better make decisions about what model of instruction our schools should be using. And so really my presentation today is really building off of the information that the governor is sharing right now. We shared this very same slide deck, just so you know, with superintendents at about 11:30 today, and we will be sharing them with the Massachusetts Association of School Committees later on this afternoon. And so really the timing for today's discussion really couldn't be better. And so I'm glad to just jump right into it with you. Just, I want to remind all of you and ground our discussion in the reminder that all of the decisions that we've made about reopening for this upcoming school year have been really made in conjunction closely with leading health experts in our state who we are so fortunate to have and to be able to work with, such as the entire Command Center advisory panel, the advisory board that we work with, Dr. Sandy Nelson, who's been on many calls with superintendents answering their questions, Chief of Infectious Disease at Massachusetts General Hospital, and Dr. Lloyd Fisher, who's the incoming president of the Massachusetts Associate Chapter of the Academy of Pediatrics. I'm also obviously very pleased that Dr. Larry Madoff is with us, who is sort of part of the overall COVID command structure, as am I, all of us working on the governor's team, and our partnership with the Department of Public Health is so vital and so important to this work. Larry and I began our day together at 7:30 today, and I'm sure we will be talking again tomorrow as we continue to align our work. So as I'm sure all of you are aware, we have a due date of this Friday for the final plans from schools and districts about their expectation, their plans for returning to school following a continuum of options. And really with our belief in this state that we need to be ready to pivot. And so frankly, we are choosing an option to start the year with. And it might change during the school year. And I know that's challenging. I'm not saying that with any sort of glib note in my voice whatsoever. I have been a superintendent in this state. I have been a teacher in this state. I know the work that goes into running schools and districts. And so it is obviously this is no mean task that needs to be undertaken, both the planning right now for the reopening, but then adjusting as necessary. So as I'm sure you're all abundantly aware, we are asking for three models for the plans that are due to us on Friday, the in-person learning with safety requirements, a hybrid model and a remote model. When the plan comes in, we expect to be you to identify your superintendent to send us based on the vote of your school committee, what model you are planning to start with. And so, but again, I think that's different than some other states that have just sort of mandated one model. We've said, let's be ready to pivot. Let's be ready to kind of shift as the virus, unfortunately, will dictate some of what we do and where we go. So we appreciate the additional guidance that the governor put out last Friday, really because what we see behind that guidance, and we just know how much of a value it is for him, that we want students to be in schools. We want people to be in our buildings, in our school buildings. As lovely as our beaches are in Massachusetts, it's really not our public priority is to be having crowds on our beaches. We want safe groups of students in our schools. And so we included in this presentation just a link to the order that came out on August 7th that further decreased groupings and the numbers of people who can be together indoors and outdoors. And just one point of clarification that's come up for us from superintendents is particularly where this order for indoor gatherings says that they need to be limited. There's other verbiage around this, but limited to groups of 25. That's sort of a rule of thumb. It's important to note that there is an exception for K-12 schools, public and private schools. And so really just understanding that we believe that with the right health and safety features in place, such as wearing masks, maintaining physical distance, good hand hygiene, and staying out when anybody is feeling symptoms, showing symptoms, stay home if you're sick, the combination of those four factors make our schools safe to be at in person. That's why we really want to lean in on reopening our schools and having as much in-person instruction as possible, while also recognizing that it might be something that we have to grow towards as the school year resumes. So again, though, we do this because we so value the in-person instruction that occurs between teachers and students. We feel like the connection is at its best. We've just heard too many firsthand stories from parents and caregivers in particular about the challenges that they had with remote learning last year. And we want to get back to what we know is best for kids. And also just not to mention the social emotional component of learning. I appreciate that the American Academy of Pediatrics has spoken about, the impact, the negative impact that being out of school can have on students' social and emotional development, and then needing to weigh that into as a consideration about maintaining a remote model. So with that in mind, we are moving in some directions to help the reopening of schools. And again, an area that I'm sure you're aware of is that the commissioner and our department and the AFT, the MTA, and the Boston Teachers Union all agreed to an MOU that allows for 10 days of training before the school year begins. We have had a lot of questions, maybe to preempt anything that would come up in the chat, about, can those days be banked? Do they all need to be used all at once? And what we're saying on that is that we do actually need the days to be used all at once. Those 10 training days need to be used to kind of prepare for any of the contingencies. Are you opening in a hybrid model and therefore need to spend some of the time talking about the health and safety protocols that need to be in place and some of the time talking about the remote learning that would go on with a hybrid model. All that needs to take place as best as you can during the 10 days. At the same time, if you have other professional development days that you were planning to use before the school year began, you could certainly bank those days. Those days could be used at another point during the school year, which I think is probably a good idea. I work closely with the approved special education schools in the state and the residential schools in particular that stayed open throughout the pandemic. And really my hat is off to them for the great work that they did. And they've certainly given us a lot to learn from. And we've listened closely to their experiences. And they've said, they really valued opportunities to adjust their strategy, to bring staff together, to have those learning opportunities. And so if there is a way to, have kind of, periodic check-ins during the school year to adjust as necessary, I think that would be beneficial for faculty and students and staff alike. So I'd be glad to answer any other questions that there are about those 10 days. We've had questions about, do they apply to collaboratives and other educational institutions? What about charter schools? So if there are any questions, I'll be glad to take those towards the end. But here now, let's start talking about the metric. And so coming from Johns Hopkins University, and I'm sure you've heard a lot about the data that Johns Hopkins are pulling together on a regular basis. But when we look at just positivity levels as a starting point, and I think what's really important about what I'm going to say is that there is no one trigger. There's no one kind of, anything where we're looking at the data, it needs to be further delved into and not just sort of, taken as the only decision decider or the only kind of leverage point in making decisions. But as kind of a starting point, when we see the states that are in green here that have positivity rates lower than 5%, and how where Massachusetts is sort of faring right now and has fared over time, we see that we really should be, as a state, strongly considering for education, having in-person learning. We are not at a point as an entire state where we would be prohibited from that, as we can see in some other states. And I appreciate that Commissioner Riley says, you know, when I think about being the commissioner in another state, I might view this differently. But in Massachusetts, where we are so squarely in the green, we really do need to be opening up this conversation about what can we do to offer in-person experiences for students. And so what we're moving towards now is, though, to look more closely community by community, because the story of the state is not a uniform story. There are differences across the state and within different communities. And we want to be responsive to that. And we think that working from data will be perhaps more powerful than, in some cases, working from anecdote or speculation about the course of the virus. Let's peer into the data more closely. And so the governor is announcing more broadly today, and then what we're applying more narrowly to education and public education contexts is a color coding metric that we will be sharing more information out about in the coming days. Initially, we'll put something out later on today, but then more information as the week unfolds. If you could lean in on what we will be saying with our color coding is really looking at the metric as being the average daily cases per 100,000 and kind of how we're grouping based on that data metric, starting, and again, it's a starting point. It's a starting point for the conversation, I hope, as we continue to go forward. That if we see average daily cases of greater than 100,000, average daily cases per 100,000 greater than 8, our recommendation would be to go remote. You are likely in a place where that needs to be strongly considered to help stop the spread, to help bring down this incidence rate. Whereas if you are in yellow, where the average daily case per 100,000 is between 4 and 8, likely remote, likely hybrid, but remote might be what's necessary if there are extenuating circumstances. And those circumstances might be things like building conditions. Kind of how do we put together the various factors that you have locally about what it will take to offer a hybrid model? And so hybrid or remote, and then remote kind of based on those extenuating circumstances. And then, green being for those average daily cases per 100,000, less than 4. Again, our, take would be full in-person or hybrid, again, if there are some extenuating circumstances. And then the unshaded would be if there are fewer than 5 cases over the past 14 days, particularly in smaller communities. And so in smaller communities, obviously, we have to peer in more closely. The denominator is different. For very small communities, this is, again, a starting point for a conversation, but where there are fewer than 5 cases, we're hoping that the starting point can be leaning more towards full-time, in-person, or hybrid, and then seeing where the conversation takes you from there. And so this is all measured on the, as the asterisk shows at the bottom, all measured on the 14-day rolling average and reported as part of the Department of Public Health's online dashboard. And again, more to come on that as the dashboard that's currently available continues to be updated. So a few other considerations. So remember that I said that we look at this color coding as a starting point. And so we would want schools and districts to be looking at some other key data elements, such as whether or not cases are increasing or decreasing versus the prior period. And so what we're advising is, now, this isn't probably a rush to judgment. This is probably looking at these reports over time and seeing where your municipality stands. But are the cases increasing or decreasing? Monitoring positive test results, positive rates, positivity rates is also really important. And then just working with your local Board of Health to consider what additional metrics and underlying data might indicate the trends that are going on locally. So, and we will provide some additional guidance on scenarios so that we can help sort of with that judgment call that will ultimately need to be made. Where this is a starting point using multiple weeks of data, and I know the question will come up, some of you have already voted, many of you are on your school committees, or you have a vote coming up, and we've been asked to to produce data like this. And so there wouldn't be the expectation that you necessarily have to go and revote right now, but we do want you looking at this for your decision-making over time. So perhaps those of you who haven't voted yet this week, this could be looked at. Those of you who have voted last week or maybe even as soon as tonight, then we would ask that you kind of, where I said that we will pivot during the school year, we are likely to have to introduce, you know, more than one model during the school year, evolve models during the school year, that we hope that you will take a look at this to make those decisions, perhaps now, but definitely in the future, to guide the decision-making of your school committees in particular, of the work that you do so closely with your superintendents. And then finally, we will issue more guidance for regional districts and municipalities and towns that draw from many different cities and towns from across the state. So if you are a district that has high choice rates, for example, then we want to help guide you on how you would make the decision if you have a high number of school choice students. If you're a regional district, charter schools, regional charter schools will need this information. Collaboratives, approved special education schools will all need this information. So I'm sure this will bring up a lot of questions, and I'm glad to do what I can to answer them today. This is sort of the beginning point of a new era of working from these data, and I really appreciate what I hope this will do for us as we move forward. The one final thing that I'll mention along these lines is that, you know, I know that there are decisions being made right now about going remote and how remote is remote. So in some cases, I'm seeing municipalities saying we're mostly going to start remote, but we will allow for our most vulnerable students to get some in-person services. I also wear the hat of being the State Director of Special Education, and just a reminder that our guidance that we put out in early July is that students who have significant and complex disabilities likely need those in-person services more than many other groups, and so they should be prioritized for in-person services. So I'm very appreciative of the communities that have started with saying, yes, we will be remote, but we are going to allow many of our students with disabilities, particularly those with complex and significant disabilities, to continue to receive in-person services in our schools. I appreciate the communities that are saying our English learners can receive in-person services. Some where I know a direction could be going to allow students who get vocational services to perhaps get those in person. But I am very appreciative of where we haven't started with the all means all, meaning, you know, we aren't going to offer any in-person services. We are shutting down for remote entirely. I just think that there will be some challenges legally even around this idea that we can't provide in-person services. Unless it's for a surge, if the positivity rate is showing and the cases per 100,000 are showing that we really have to be in that red zone and we can't provide in-person services across the board, that makes sense. That's just not the case for a lot of our districts, and the data will continue to show that right now. I'm getting questions about, you know, what will this mean legally? What will parents' rights be? And I think it's going to be a challenge, particularly in special education, where there are more parent protections than there are for example, English learners or students attending vocational programs. All very important, but particularly where there are some legal consequences, students not getting a free and appropriate public education, and where our guidance since early July was to provide as many of those in-person services as possible. I would just ask that if those of you who have said remote for all, perhaps look closely at that decision, look to see what can be done. Keep in mind when in our guidance, when we said that no services, if a district gets to a point where no services are offered in the school, then they need to consider home or community-based services, which are going to bring up many questions as well, I am sure. Where our value, the department is always thinking about who are the most vulnerable students, how are we making sure we provide the best quality education to every child in the state, but also looking to overcome the inequities that are often associated with our most vulnerable students. I just ask that you consider that closely in terms of the decisions that are being made, because I know this is just such a pivotal time, and anything we can do to really support our families is really, and our students is really what we want to do first and foremost right now. So Jeff, glad to turn it over for questions and glad to go into any other aspects of this more deeply in terms of where we're at right now with our reopening guidance.
Thank you, Commissioner. I do notice that the Lieutenant Governor has joined us. So before we take questions for you, I think we'd want to turn to Lieutenant Governor Karen Pulido.
Commissioner, go right ahead.
Okay, so we can take questions.
If he has to go, if you have other things you're working on, we appreciate your presentation today. That was very well done, but I do see a number of questions in the chat. Happy to wait.
Okay, thank you, Lieutenant Governor. You're always so accommodating to everyone's schedules, and your schedule is probably busier than anyone else's except the governor's. So there are some questions in the chat for this, and we'll just make sure to leave enough time so Lieutenant Governor has some really big substantive items to talk about with municipal executives as well. So I'll just scroll up to the and skip the pure public health ones regarding the travel order and go to the ones that are education related. Can the 10 days be used, this is regarding the training period, can the 10 days be used for meetings with students one-on-one or in small groups if we're going into remote instruction for opening day?
Yes, they can be. So we've discussed that in some of the conference calls that we've had with district leaders to say that, you know, it's really a local decision in terms of how those days are used. But things like orientation and small group meetings, individual meetings, would certainly be a very appropriate use of that time.
And your PowerPoint presentation gave I think for the first time to local officials, the visual of the red, the yellow, the green, and the white, and the categorization using data for communities. The question is, with the green, yellow, red grading information, it would have been useful to school committees as they deliberated last week. So do you plan on using this assessment now if the school committee has already voted? So do you anticipate many circumstances where a school committee might want to change their minds based on receiving this data?
You know, we hope that the data are influential. We hope that they do help to drive decision making. And so, you know, we aren't demanding that there's a reconsideration, but I think that, you know, where they are publicly available, where they are hopefully easily understandable and digestible, we would ask that they are a factor in considerations for, you know, at any point. So, you know, reopening the conversation as is necessary for your community needs to be made at a local level. But I definitely hope the data will be used. I think they should be a kind of a strong anchor for decisions about reopening and any changes that are made during the school year.
And the data will be updated on a weekly basis using that rolling 14-day average of daily positives test.
Correct.
The next question is, what do you mean by monitoring positive testing as a metric to review? So when you were talking about the various metrics to use.
Sure. And I mentioned the Johns Hopkins study uses positivity rates. And for the metric, we're using cases per 100,000 because that helps to sort of even out the analysis by community so that the population size of the community is not as much a factor. And certainly Dr. Madoff could chime in here further, being a more expert in this than I am. But we think that both are important. So the rating is based on the cases per 100,000. But I'm sure many of us have looked at the data that's on the Department of Public Health's website. And if not, I can put the link in the chat when I'm done. But there you can find the positivity rates as well. And so we're saying that, you know, again, start with the cases per 100,000 and then also look at your positivity rate, and particularly where is it changing over time? Is it decreasing or increasing? Is just another factor to be considered.
Also, another question, and this has to do also with the fact that individual districts also have to reach an understanding with their local teachers unions as well. It seems as though the concerns of local teachers unions may be a challenge implementing DESE's recommendations. If there's pushback, for example, from unions in communities that would be, say, a green or a white on the map communities, but what advice do you have for communities that are still facing some resistance from the local union regarding in-person services, even though they would be, one of the recommended courses by the state for those communities.
So I hope that these data are helpful because, again, we can get beyond kind of anecdote or speculation and really drill down to the facts, which I think will help to guide the conversation. My recommendation, having been a superintendent, is to stay at the table and to continue to work things out. I know the commissioner has had many ongoing conversations with the leaders of the unions, and we will continue to do so at the state level and at the local level. That's ultimately, it's where everything happens, is between you and your local union leadership. And so I would ask that you continue to push. And again, just use the data as the North Star for the decision making that needs to be made.
Next question is, do you have any advice or guidelines for school committees that are considering school-wide testing for both staff and students?
So we actually will have more to come on this soon. It's an area of work that I'm very actively invested in myself right now, and really appreciate the great, really, problem solving that is happening across state government right now around this. And if you wouldn't mind just giving us a little bit more time, we will have more information for you on testing very soon. And I think it'll be positive and helpful news.
There's a question about what about teachers and staff who may be traveling to the school district from moderate or high risk municipalities?
This is something that we have thought about as well. And it's not, again, it's both the students and the staff. So we've thought about, you know, what will be some of the reactions to these data that are unintended, such as, you know, staff coming from other communities, students coming from other communities. And so we will continue to update our advice on this to support, again, as much rational thinking around these topics as we can. And again, we will continue to, as I mentioned at the beginning of the presentation, continuing to work with our outstanding medical advisors here in the state to help us with these decisions.
And a related question on testing, are there any plans on providing metrics either at the state or local level, by school, by grade, to expand the green, yellow, red indications, and to use contract tracing to identify school hotspots versus the aggregate numbers?
Interesting question. You know, mainly we've drilled down to the city and town level and not so much within the city and town. And so I think that, you know, particularly where we're looking for trends over time and wanting to be, you know, kind of thoughtful about increasing and decreasing rates, that 14-day rolling average, I think that that's really where we'd want people's attention to be. And, you know, if there are sort of, you know, clusters, then I think some of the advice, some of the support that we will provide likely around testing should help with where you might see kind of a cluster effect coming up. I think it would be more of a testing response than a data response, frankly.
A side topic, but a very important one. When will a recommendation come from from the state regarding fall sports and how programs should proceed?
So we know how important this is, and it is very much, again, being actively worked on right now, and I anticipate we will have more information for you very, very soon. We are just trying not to be kind of capricious about this. We want to be very thoughtful about a topic that is so important to so many.
For schools going back to an in-person instruction model or a hybrid model, will a positive COVID test for a single student in a single school result in a move to all remote? Or what protocols would be in place or advice you would give regarding test results and whether or not that leads to a shift?
This is a great question, and I really appreciate it. And I appreciate it from the vantage point of, again, the residential schools that stayed open all throughout the crisis, and we listened carefully to their experiences. And I talked to one director of a residential school, again, for children with severe disabilities, who said, you know, people need to take the attitude of not if they will have a positive COVID-19 case, but when they will have a COVID-19 case. And that we will be resilient. We will work our way through it. And, you know, I'm so proud of the school districts that offered in-person extended school year services to students with disabilities this summer. I recently did a survey with schools and districts. We had over 90 responses. 3,000 students received in-person services this summer. And we did have a small handful of positive cases in our, in some ways associated, because with our schools, because, you know, when you think about the cast of thousands associated with running school, from bus monitors and bus drivers, cafeteria workers, you know, not during the summer, but, you know, when you think about everybody, the many, many, many people we have involved in our schools, we will have cases. And we need to take the attitude that, these will occur and we can find our way through them. And again, I'm speaking to many of you right now who led these schools and districts, whose schools and districts faced these issues this summer. And again, there weren't many, but they did occur and you stayed open. Not one public school closed this summer because they had a positive case. And we want to be there with you. We want to support you and answer your questions when they come up, because they will. But it is very much my hope that by beginning this school year with the understanding that we will have cases, but we will find our way through them, is the starting point. But obviously also working with your local Board of Health and, you know, with us, DESE, around where is the point where you might have to make a different decision. But it's certainly not one case. And I would strongly advise you, and, you know, because many of you are involved, like, you know, leading your school committees or very much present and members of your school committees, to be having the conversation now about we are going to face this. This is going to happen and we are going to get through it. Because we've got a lot of the right protocols in place, because we've already put on the table how we will respond when we get a positive case, how we will notify families. And I'm going to stop talking here in just a minute, but I also think that, you know, talking to your families now about, you know, this is what we're going to do when we get a positive case will help take down the pressure when it actually happens, because I think that there will be a lot of fear and anxiety when we face our first few cases this year. And we just need to, I think forewarning and advanced communication will help bring down the anxiety when it occurs.
Thank you. We have a couple more questions for you, then we'll go to the Lieutenant Governor. There are many concerns from teachers regarding their own safety in contracting COVID. Can you speak to that and the protections that are being put in place, the protocols for teachers?
You know, we've worked so closely again with the Medical Advisory Board and then Dr. Sandy Nelson and Dr. Lloyd that we feel very strongly that our schools are safe places when we put those four critical components in place: face masks, physical distancing, hand washing, and staying out when you are symptomatic. So that, you know, when I've talked to Dr. Nelson about this personally, she has said our schools are safer than going to the grocery store. You know, with those types of protections in place, we are as equally safe, if not more. In fact, we are more safer in our schools than we are in many of the other places that we are actively choosing to go to in our communities. And so, you know, I feel very strongly that the advice that we have, and again, it's simple, it's easy to follow, will keep our staff safe. You know, we will continue to, you know, bring new information to bear as we get it about, you know, the virus is, you know, we're learning a lot about the virus as well. And so ways that we can fine tune this advice, but we know that right now and going into the future, these same strategies are going to work. And I just anticipate kind of fine tuning as we go to keep them effective. So I'm very confident that our staff and our students will be safe when we reopen schools. And again, we showed it this summer. We showed that it can happen. And so let's build on our confidence.
And then a question about transportation. It's a huge issue in reopening, of course. Are districts required to cut the number of students on a bus in half or lower? What is the rule or the advice?
Sure. So, yeah, before I go, I'll put a couple of links in the chat, and one will be our transportation guidance. And so we do, just as in schools, recommend physical distancing on buses. And so kind of a 3-foot rule of thumb for the distance between students, so that you have kind of staggered seating. If you can kind of imagine students kind of seating on a diagonal, so that, you know, you have a student on an aisle, a student in a window, a student on an aisle, a student in a window, is basically the way that the diagrams read. And they're very simple to understand and review when you see them. I hope our transportation guidance can help to answer other questions that you might have about transportation.
Great, thank you. And while you put that in the chat, we'll also include that link and also the PowerPoint that you showed in the summary article of this regarding this call that will be posted on the MMA website as well for everyone to get. And then I was wrong. There is one last question for you at this stage. What's being done to ensure consistency with whether and what sports will be allowed between school and youth sports, with Energy and Environmental Affairs having issued guidance for youth and not sure who ultimately is responsible for schools, perhaps MIAA or in consultation with DESE? Could you provide some clarification on that?
Yeah, fine question. And we're so pleased that all three parties are very much at the table together. So EEA, MIAA, and DESE are actively involved in these conversations so that there won't be daylight is our very much our hope and our plan that when the athletics guidance comes out, it will be universally supported by all organizations providing youth sports.
Thank you, Commissioner, very much. And thank you for running through all of these questions in a very efficient time and leaving plenty of time, of course, for the Lieutenant Governor right now. So will you be able to stick around for a little bit?
I'll stick around and put some things in the chat. But yes, absolutely. Thanks so much.
Excellent. Thank you. And Lieutenant Governor, thank you so much for joining us. And we look forward to your words today. And thank you for your leadership. And as you stressed at your 12 o'clock press conference with the governor, your partnership with municipalities working in tandem as a team with the local leaders from across Massachusetts, we appreciate your efforts so much. Lieutenant Governor, the floor is yours.
Okay, first of all, thank you to the commissioner. He did a really great job in running through some substantive information, literally fresh off of the press conference, and there's a lot in there. The one question that I heard asked, I wish this was available last week. This is not a perfect process, and we try to make the best decisions with the information that we have available to us at the time, which is clearly what was happening with some of the school committees gathering last week to make these decisions. This is information that will continue to change. We'll continue to have these conversations. Some communities will flow into yellow and green, and some will flow back up that stream, and we'll continue to monitor the data and make the decisions. And reconsiderations moving into the school year, which is maybe a month away, if you start mid-September, things could look a lot different in your community and could be after even starting further adjustments need to be made. So that's the challenging part of this, the flexibility that we all need to have here. I just want to thank the commissioner. I also want to thank Dr. Madoff for being on. I see Sean Cronin as well from DLS. I think Commissioner Ferguson may be on, or if Dr. Madoff has to get off. And I know that our legal department is on too, if you have some specific technical questions on the travel order or other items. Just starting on that partnership, just take a pause and look at where we are in the Commonwealth today. If you watched any part of the press conference, you saw the map of the Commonwealth. It's a map that we all know so well, and it's one that I pay a lot of attention to, given that there are 351 of you. And you all have unique challenges and opportunities. And obviously the condition of the virus is different in different places. We took all of that into consideration when developing this system of assessment and including the analysis for smaller populated communities and understanding how to create a metric that can work there as well. And when you think about 318 communities, either unshaded or green, that's a pretty powerful number. And 33 in a between state is a manageable number. And in a virus level in those communities, that if we partner together like we are known to do, bring the toolkit right to your community and you pick and choose what you think are the most effective ways to address the virus, you will see a change. We look at Lowell, you look at Lawrence. I don't know if Mayor Rivera is on, but you know he's a very active out there literally in the streets. And he's driven his number down significantly by making some adjustments locally. And this is the world we're gonna have to live in, but we're smarter, we have more data, and we have more tools and resources available to us to do this, for all of us to do this compared to when we get started. So the map is a good place, the reflection of a ton of hard work on your part. So having said that, you know that last Friday, we took some additional action. I don't want to spend a lot of time on it because it would be review. All of you are pretty well up to speed on those things. But the reason why we took the action regarding the gathering order and just a pause on step two of phase three is because of the information that we've received through your local boards of health and from you as community officials about what's going on. It is summer. We have these few months of the year that we love to enjoy, and there are some people that are just enjoying it just a little too much in terms of activity that is not distant, doesn't include a cover, and choices that some people are making that are leading to spread. We've heard these anecdotes from many of you, and it's supported by the data. So that's why we wanted to message around the gathering order, and also working with your municipal police departments and our state police to provide you with additional powers to intervene if you need to. We clearly don't want to be in the business of writing and citating people. We want to prevent this activity. But the deterrence factor, knowing that it could happen, is a big one. And it clearly relates to the travel order that we put in place. You know, if you are one of those states that have a higher risk level and you're looking to come here, we don't want to make it easy for you to just enter the Commonwealth. We want to make it harder for you. So it's a deterrent. These tools that we released on Friday with more enforcement and having the enforcement teams and the intervention teams is meant to help, but also to be a deterrent in terms of behavior that is not helpful when we still have the virus present in places of our Commonwealth. We did, and also on that, the restaurants, you know, there were some that said, why would you consider rolling back into a different phase? And we considered all of that, but my feedback, and the governor's as well, for many industries and businesses within industry sectors are compliant. This group, all of you working with our reopening board, did a lot of work to put protocols together and help businesses comply. All of us have had experiences perhaps going to a grocery store or doing something locally, and many are meeting that compliance. The outliers, when we see them and know about them, we take action on them, whether it was the charter boat in Boston that we saw and we said, how did someone make that decision and think that was a good idea? Well, the wedding up in Gardner that involved hundreds of people. So we don't want to punish everyone, right? If they're doing the right thing and trying really hard to be compliant, we want to go after what's not working and address that. And that's where this partnership and working together really matters. So on the restaurant stuff, we went more after the bars that were trying to say that they were a restaurant, but they really were just serving drinks with no real food. And we updated some guidance there too. We're happy to work with you on that. I am getting some feedback from restaurants that think that they should comply with the new gathering order. You might be getting questions like that. So restaurants follow the restaurant guidance. Businesses follow the industry specific guidance. The update to the gathering order addresses public and private events. So if you are a restaurant or a hotel hosting a wedding, for instance, the gathering order would limit that wedding to 50 from 100. But if you are a restaurant that's just normally providing table dining service, you follow your restaurant guidance for that. So that was important, and we'll probably bring some clarity to that in our guidance document. I also just want to acknowledge today, you listened perhaps to the governor's address with our new system, traffic light system, to assess the presence of the virus in the community. A couple of things there. 318 communities either unshaded or green, 33 communities in that yellow phase and 4 in the red phase. I would say on the yellow, that increasing, decreasing piece of this is really important to look at, because I really believe in these yellow communities. If you're one of them, you're sitting here saying, how am I going to get to green? I certainly don't want to go to red. So what are the things I need to be looking at? And that's where the data around the contact tracing that your local boards of health are doing or that we can help you with is really important. Because your data might tell you that the cases that you have are in a perhaps congregate care setting, or they're in a nursing home, or maybe there was an event in your community that created a situation, or maybe it is a DCR park or a beach. So you'll be able to figure out what the origin of this through the tracing program. If you need any help with that, just ask, and we will help you figure that out. What the governor and I called all of these communities last night, and one community said, I just can't figure out what the origin of my case positive is. So that's an area where we would be happy to help do a little bit more investigation with you to figure it out. And then take advantage of the resource kit that we have, whether it's messaging, reverse 911, using social media more aggressively, signage around your community, displaying these messages, and or if more testing and the like is needed, we can obviously talk about that. You know that we have 17 Stop the Spread testing sites. We have done over 50,000 tests in those sites and have extended the time that those sites will be available to September 12th, and that may continue to be available. It's free, and people can use that for their communities or for their own knowledge if needed. For instance, if someone is traveling out of state, and the travel order, I think this group is familiar with what we landed on there, but there is a question around what do you do with your own municipal employees. I hope that we brought some clarity to you based upon what the state government is doing. But certainly, first of all, discourage business travel to one of these higher risk states. Discourage the personal travel to one of these places. If your employee does have this conversation that they are going, there is the protocol around testing and or quarantining. And upon return, being able to display the test or even demonstrating that they've scheduled the test so that upon return, they are going to have it. And then be able to work with you as an employer around whether you work in person in your municipal facility or if it's a telework situation. And if it can't be a telework situation, how you're going to pay for that quarantine period if that is needed. And that's where on the municipal, from the state perspective, that employee may be eligible for paid leave to cover that time. But we want to reduce the number of incidents that trigger that scenario. As you can see from our guidance, and I'm certain that you've looked at that and would incorporate that into yours. I do know that there were some questions around Rhode Island being our bordering state that had a higher rate of COVID positive, which put them into that category and makes it very challenging being a bordering community. So, yes, if you're going into Rhode Island for recreational purposes or leisure purposes, the quarantine, the travel order does apply to you with a test. But if you are traveling into Rhode Island for medical reasons or for work or coming across our border, that's obviously part of the exemption. And we're updating the FAQ to provide a little bit more detail for all of you to understand what that transient kind of going over that border means, whether it's getting a prescription or going to a grocery store or going to visit a sick relative. Are those the kinds of things that you can go across the border for? And we will speak to that in the FAQ that is going to be released. So that should be coming your way very soon. Let's see. I don't want to go over too much of what's already gone over. I'd rather leave us 10 minutes of time to go through any questions that you have for our team, if that's okay.
Well, thank you very much, Lieutenant Governor. There's a lot that has happened in the last couple of weeks, so we thank you so much for scheduling this briefing. Originally, we were going to go to the end of August, but so much has happened.
I wanted to get together because I knew this was going to be important for all of you. And the end of August seems like so far away.
Yes, it does. And specifically regarding the Commonwealth's human resources policy regarding vacation leave and the treatment of employees who wish to travel to non-low risk states, we have posted that on the MMA website and included it in the most recent reminder of this briefing. So that policy is available, and we encourage all local officials to take a look at that and incorporate those same procedures into what you're doing locally as well. We have a few questions here. One, back a little earlier, which is a challenging one, but it was asked, which has to do with, has the administration thought about categorizing teachers as essential workers to essentially compel them to go to work if in-person teaching is part of the model? Have you contemplated that, or is that more of a Board of Education issue?
Well, that was more of an issue at the beginning of the pandemic when we literally closed down much of the operations, public and private, in the Commonwealth, and then had to deem certain positions essential in order to deal with people getting sick and people that need services in order to live and exist here in the Commonwealth. We're in a different place now because we have reopened much of our public and private places. There's some left in step two of phase three, which we paused, and of course some large venue kinds of operations in phase four, but we're in a different place. So that categorizing doesn't seem relevant to the time that we have. I believe that we've always held as a norm throughout this process that we need to rely on the data and the science and the medical advice from people who have worked as part of our team at the COVID Command Center to make decisions, making the right ones at the right time with the information that's available to us. We arrived today at a place because we have access to clear data that allows us to really understand where we are as a Commonwealth. We've been using more statewide numbers. So when we say we're at a 1.8% COVID in Massachusetts, that's a really great number, but it doesn't really tell you how you're doing in Salem or Worcester or Shrewsbury or Swampscott. And that's why the data today is really relevant to helping municipal leaders, school districts, businesses understand what they can and cannot do in their community or what they need to do more of. And we think that's a more appropriate way to work with school districts in making decisions for the upcoming school year, and also allow us the flexibility to pivot depending on what could come our way. But I really believe that we use this data and we really aggressively treat the communities that have more to prevent it from spreading beyond those communities and really help communities drive it down and get into the green and unshaded area. We hopefully will avoid the spike in the outbreaks that you're seeing in other places in the country. So that's really the goal. So I think that we're at a different place than when we started. And I don't think that those categorizations really where we are at this time.
Here's a question. Just as getting to that, everyone's trying to understand the gatherings order. For the 50-person gathering order limit outdoors in regards to sporting events, does that include the players and the and those in attendance in the audience?
Okay, so we on that score, you should follow the current guidance that EEA has issued. We are going to update that guidance. I don't have a specific date for you now, but I know that the time for updating that guidance for youth and amateur sports is very soon. And it will provide guidance for MIAA and DESE and the school districts to use, as well as independent schools and other leagues and organizers of sports to use. And I could envision something around like 50, excluding coaches, players, facility managers, and the like from that 50 number for an outdoor event, for example. That could be what you would see in the next guidance. But now you should just follow the industry-specific guidance that's available through EEA.
Oh, thank you. This is a question regarding, is there an update on the administration's acquisition of 500,000 antigen or rapid test kits and a pipeline to get them delivered to local school districts? And can the state streamline the process to get municipal departments, school nurses licensed through the clinical lab program so they can utilize these tests as part of a school's ability to rapidly test symptomatic students and staff?
Okay. You heard the commissioner talk about testing as being an important piece of this. There's more to come on that. There's a lot of substance in that question, and we greatly appreciate that. And you know how much we value in terms of our reopening strategy and our ability to address the virus spread, that testing is a big part of it. So just more to come, and maybe by our next meeting, we'll have more to discuss on that topic with you. If you need something more immediate, we can take that offline to answer that specific question separately from our conversation now.
Thank you. Here's a question. If municipal officials have specific questions about the travel order to high-risk states, is there someone at the state level they can call and ask a question of?
Of course. And I know that Elizabeth Denniston did update with the actual link to the guidance. So you can see it there in the chat room. And yes, through you, Jeff, we're happy to address any specific questions that one of your members might have.
Great. And so, for example, here's one.
And you might, if my staff is on, if you want to put your contact information on the chat, that person can contact you directly.
Excellent. That's great. Thank you. If a state employee vacations in a non-exempt or a non-low-risk state and must quarantine, are they allowed to use accrued sick time? I think that's a little more complicated question, because if they're forced to quarantine, I think the Families First Coronavirus Act leave, which is an additional 10 days, may be triggered. Is that correct, Elizabeth?
That is correct. The FFCRA says that if you are required to quarantine pursuant to a state order, that you are eligible for paid leave. But that said, if you should look at the state policy, because I think it does allow flexibility around that, which is really important, including that an employer could, the other option is an employer could, as the Commonwealth may, require their employee to get a test and return to work on time and not take those additional 14 days. I think you should work with your employee to see, are they a teleworker? Can they quarantine at home? Or do you need them in the office? Therefore, we're going to ask them to get a test and come back to work.
Thank you.
You can use one of the 17 sites also to schedule your test upon arrival, so that you'll know your status, that and it may not trigger the 14-day quarantine if you have a negative test.
Yes, yes, and that could be made as a condition of the vacation leave being granted.
That's correct.
Rescheduling the test. Is DESE approving the plans submitted by districts? We submitted our draft plan intending on remote, but it sounds like we should be considering hybrid, and our final plan may be different from the draft. I don't think we received any feedback on the first submission. Should we expect feedback or approval? So is DESE approving the plan, or is it just having communities go through the process of reviewing the various options and then deciding on one that best fits?
Yeah, I think it's a little of both, and the time to submit has been extended to this Friday. I will be speaking with the commissioner later and, you know, raise this issue that I'm hearing this with all of you, that some decisions have been made, but this data today is really important and might needing an opportunity to at least talk about the plan that has been submitted and maybe reconsidering some parts of that. But we would want to have some flexibility to have those conversations with you.
Thank you. Here's the next question. Has DPH or another agency advanced the plan for local boards of health and school districts to upload, I just lost the question here, to rapidly upload a school student rosters so that the contact tracing may be an easier process if it's needed?
I see Dr. Madoff has joined us, and maybe you can address that.
Yeah, so as was mentioned earlier, we are working with DESE on updating our contact tracing guidance around schools, around K-12 in particular. So stay tuned for that. We'll have more information on that.
Thank you. Here's a question about looking for the link to the state's guidance on your travel policy for employees. We actually have it. There's a small article on the front page of the MMA website at mma.org. Just go to that mma.org site, and you'll be able to then get linked to a PDF of the state's HR travel policy. And I see Elizabeth Denniston has posted the guidance for travelers arriving in the Commonwealth. Thank you. It's a question for you, Elizabeth. How was Chapter 277, Section 70C chosen for enforcement in the travel order? No health agent has ever used that standard, and no court clerk knows how to handle that procedure. We're used to having a simple civil fine ticket procedure as a default when we do routine enforcement.
You know, that's helpful feedback for us to hear. We had used that standard because it sets forth a process for issuing a citation for public health standards, so we thought it was an applicable and understandable one for localities. Hearing that, though, let me find out more, and I can get more feedback to you, Jeff, to better answer that question.
Great, and then we'll share all that answer with our membership via our website and through the next notice of these meetings. We provide answers to the questions and links to those. And Candace Pierce of the MMA has already posted the link right there for the policy. Jessica from the governor's office, Bellevaux from the governor's office has given her information, her email address for specific questions that are outstanding. And so just look for that on the chat if you have other questions. And then we have a question here. Oh no, Elizabeth has also posted some additional information. I believe, Lieutenant Governor, that we have run through the vast bulk of the questions. If there are any outstanding, we'll forward those to Jessica in your office. But turn to you right now to see if there are any closing words. And again, express appreciation for all of this work and the collaboration with the communities, in particular the 33 communities who you're working with to provide additional resources and support as they work to get those numbers down.
Yeah, it's great. Just thank you for all of your efforts. You're tireless, it's 24/7, it's hard work. We appreciate the opportunity to work with you and your willingness to collaborate and cooperate on so many levels, but I really believe it's why we have arrived at this point in time. The data looks as it is, and there's always more to do. But I hope that this information that we released today will be helpful to all of you. And thank you for your efforts. And of course, as we focus so much right now on our children, our youth, and seeing them have a good school year ahead. You know, the governor said recently at a press conference, and I really understood it, did it more so as a mother. When the pandemic hit, it was at the end of the school, not the end, but going toward the end of the school year in March, where teachers and their students had a familiarity with one another and classmates had a connection. When you start the school year, that doesn't yet exist. And so the importance of having a strong start to the school year is one that we all embrace. And I was really encouraged by the numbers that we saw and were able to put into this map for communities to be able to use to make decisions to make the start of the school year as best possible for these kids, these families, and of course, our teachers and educators that are getting back into that that environment as well. So thank you all. We'll continue to work together, and I appreciate this opportunity to share this information today.
Thank you, Lieutenant Governor. And I know that our municipalities are deeply grateful for the granular information, the community by community data that will really help provide even more insight and guidance and resources for local officials. Is that map going to be posted today or tomorrow on the state's dashboard website?
It'll be posted, I believe, tomorrow.
Okay. Very good. So starting tomorrow, just go to mass.gov, click on the top link, the top COVID link, and you'll be brought to the place to find the dashboard.
Yeah, it is. It'll be tomorrow. We start the next analysis period tomorrow. And that will be updated weekly based upon a 2-week rolling period of data.
Excellent. Thank you very much on that. And again, thank you to Lieutenant Governor Polito, to all of the members of the administration, Elizabeth Denniston, Dr. Larry Madoff, Jessica for participating. This is the first call where we haven't actually had Sean Cronin have a chance to say some words. Sean, we'll get you in next time. The next municipal CEO briefing will be held on Tuesday, the 25th of August at 1 p.m., the usual time. We'll have the usual cast of extraordinary partners for all of you to provide the latest information. And we know that a lot more work will have been done in the meantime by all of you out in cities and towns leading your communities through this pandemic and through a time of great uncertainty and change, but also progress. So thank you for your work, and we look forward to seeing you next time. Have a good afternoon.
Thank you.
Thanks.